Hello, everyone. Welcome to
Hello.
another episode of Tough to Talk About. It is great to be back.
Yes.
Hello, Elaine.
Yes. Hey, it is great. It's great to see you. I think you and I have only seen each other once since we've last heard, but we've talked. We've texted, but we haven't
seen. So do you remember the last time we saw each other?
Starbucks.
And do you remember what we saw that day?
A lot of stuff.
Do you remember the van with a coffin on it?
I do remember. There was a van with a coffin on the top, which was only in Atlanta.
Yeah.
It didn't even look like it was tied down very well. So I'm not sure.
No. It was definitely not something you see every day. But if you're going to see it, Atlanta's the place to come for that.
Yeah, that's
for
right.
For sure. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, we'll jump right in. As always, today's show is sponsored by On the Ground. Check out On the Ground at www.onthegroundstore.
Is that On the Ground that you have on today?
This is an On the Ground shirt. Brief. That's right.
Yes. Love that's it. Right. Yes. Yeah. Represent and, the brand. I would have, but I'd already put this on. I should be repping the brand.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm a bad host today.
So On the Ground .store. For some really good stuff, all intended to make us feel better, as we definitely need that. So it's definitely been a little while. We've all been busy. I know for me, I accepted a new role with an amazing company, TQ Intelligence, which we'll talk a little bit about there. It's not only been keeping me busy, but it's been keeping me happy as well, because we're doing some amazing things. So with that, I am beyond excited to have TQ Intelligence's founder and CEO, Dr. Yared Alamu, on the show today. Dr. Alamu is an expert in the area of childhood trauma and psychology. He's the CEO and founder of TQ Intelligence and has pioneered the use of voice and machine learning to determine mental health risk in kids, teens, and adolescents. And he's served as in a number of roles, leading large clinical and counseling centers focused on kids and teens and adolescents. And he just has a remarkable story. He's an incredible human being. Just grateful that our paths have crossed. It's one of those divine universe types of intersections that I'm just beyond grateful for. And not only are we doing some pretty amazing work, and not only has he built an incredible company, but we're quickly becoming good friends, which has just been amazing. So without further ado, I'd love to turn it over to Dr. Alamu to further introduce himself. And really, he's got a fascinating story. Like,
I want to hear it.
All the technology and the company and all of that is amazing, and we'll get into that. Mm-hmm. But you know, just his story and where he came from and how he ended up in psychology is just absolutely remarkable. And Dr. Alamu, it's great to have you on the show, and it's great to see you as always.
Yeah.
So, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. So why don't you jump right in? Like, you know, where'd you grow up? How'd you end up in psychology? Let's go all the way back to the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, I'm a high school dropout, and I just, you know, I just found, you know, what's going on the streets back in Ethiopia were much more interesting than what goes on at the school. So it's So you know, part of that is I grew up poor with a family that was loving and did everything they could to you know, whatever that needed to be done despite the lack of resources. And and I lost my father when I was 11 years old. It was very close to and so you have that combination of those experiences. By the time I got to 13, 14, I start getting high. And so it's a, I, perfectly understand when my young patients talk about getting high, and I don't, so when I ask them, like, what, my first question is, what is it doing for you? What, what is it that you discovered? Not whether you should not do this, it should not. And then we have very similar experiences. We just, the capacity to be able to get out or leave immediately. And that's, there's no substitute for that. I mean, no therapist, no medication, that. So, but, there's a huge consequences that comes with that. So, so that's kind of, what I, kind of, grew up, and I was, going through these kind of developmental processes with the aid of substances and other things. And then I was lucky enough to get a, academic and a soccer scholarship to come to a boarding school in Connecticut. So, I, before I dropped out, I was a pretty good student. I was a pretty good athlete. And so it's one of those things that, no amount of talent that would, kind of overcome these emotional struggles, right? And we know that we, we see that every day with African-American kids, with all kind of possibilities, but, you get swallowed by, right? You get swallowed by trauma. You get, that emotional distress kind of overpowers the potential, right? And so that's kind of what got me in psychology down the road, is that, I was able to get the opportunity to come to a boarding school, to be around people that was very giving, right? I mean, these are mostly is a group of white people that have kind of taken under, an interest in me. And that's the first time I had a, experience with therapy. And I, like, we don't do that kind of stuff from where I came from. I don't even know, what that was until I sat in a chair next to this, really kind, white dude. And I just, we just kind of sat for a while. Like, he wasn't trying to force anything. I wasn't trying to, give information on something that I wasn't sure whether, I should tell this dude. So that's kind of what, the grounding for, and then as I go through that process and went to, undergrad at Georgetown, spent a good bit of time with Jesuit priests, right? These are professors that have given their life to a cause, right? I don't know anything about Jesuits and Catholics. I'm not a religious person, but I like their integrity. Like, they're, these are the people that really get excited about talking about stuff that not many people care, right? So my, Father O'Connor is a, the psychology professor. Like, this guy's like, he cries. He's, like, in one class, he goes through all, it's like, this is where I want to go. Like, I want to have a career like this guy, who he's can be genuine and authentic about who he is without, teaching intro to psychology class, right? And so that's kind of how I came up. And what I do today is directly related to who I was. So there is kind of a continuity, my background, I've been sober for more than 30 years, which, is directly related to, having the insight and the willingness to take a risk as we do now. And the connection with Mark is based on that kind of a struggle, right? That the struggle that, just because I'm an adult on the side it's still have a kind of a 24-hour window to get through a whole bunch of stuff, to experience a whole bunch of stuff and move on, keep moving in the right direction. So I'm not sure that addresses your question, but it is, that's kind of how I ended up with artificial intelligence, and how is that connected to my background?
So I have a question though, because thank you obviously for sharing that story and how it came to be, which is interesting because you said 11 when your father passed away. So that definitely makes the connection about, you know, the focus on youth, and we'll get into a little bit later. But curious what happened, because you had the trauma, you had, you know, things that were going on in childhood and then dropped out of school. Between the time that you said, hold on, I got to get this back on the track.
That's called the proverbial shit.
Yeah. Like what happened? Because I think that's where a lot of people have stories like that, who have overcome something, but yeah, we don't necessarily know what it is. Can you pinpoint exactly what that was? And is that something that you're helping, you know, bring into the work that you're doing today? Was there one thing, or what, or can you even articulate how your life changed?
Yeah. I mean, so this is one of those things that I'm only partially aware of all the things that I played conspired for me to move in that direction. So I would be, you know, grandiose to say that I actually have a perfect insight to, you know, I was able to make this move here and this move here and this move here. That's not how my life is, right? So there's always, you know, something that is, it's not a religious experience per se, but it could be that. But it is one of those things that when I make a decision to engage with something, right? For example, I have the privilege of having a family in the US that got me into a boarding school, right? Mm-hmm. But that process has opened up a whole bunch of doors, right? It did not stop me, for example, from getting high, right? Because, you know, I found there's more dope with those white people at the boarding school than it was in when I was growing up on the street. People have the perception that, you know, there's more stuff going on with, you know, these schools was, you know, black people versus these schools was white kids in the different neighborhoods. But it is, you know, that act of willing to do something, mm-hmm, right? That very limited understanding that I have the opportunity here, right? I know nothing about treatment, right? I know nothing about, so all the stuff that I ended up taking a risk on, right? I did not resist when someone said, you know, said, this is going to be, you know, when they direct me to all these things, I would put no resistance to that. And so there is there is some level of kind of
surrender.
Yeah. Like I'm done. I can't, you know, the best, you know, all the tricks that I have in my bag, right, yeah, was not enough. Right. It helped me with something. I mean, the intellectual stuff is always, you know, easier than the emotional stuff. Mm-hmm. The physical stuff in terms of being an athlete was, you know, doesn't really require any large commitments, but the emotional stuff, right? This is, you know, I found myself the same place that I was, you know, a few years back in Ethiopia. Like, what happened? Like, you went 10,000 miles away from where you're living. Yeah. You have all this privilege. You're going to one of the top boarding schools. You have, like, sitting on the future, like I got into some colleges and all this stuff, people want to give me money, but emotionally I was the same kid that I was, mm-hmm, right, when I was at 13 and 14, and that was frightening to me, mm-hmm, right, mm-hmm. And so the drive to change, to take suggestions, to get into stuff, to get into recovery, that is not because I kind of figured this thing out, that is because I, you know, this is the only option I have. Right?
Did you have a view
I don't know if I answered that question, but that's kind of what happened.
Did you have a view on white people before you got to Connecticut?
No, not really. I mean, I don't think I've kind of, you know, there's a few white people when I grew up. But we, you know, we were kind of, you know, were protected from white people. I mean, you know, we had the same, you know, movies and ideas and all this stuff. But, you know, my first kind of immersion, that contact, right, came being in that setting. And
yeah, and the reason I asked the question is, it would be like, I was curious, you know, like you had surrendered in a way.
Yeah.
And you were, you know, I could see, well, I can't fully grasp it, but like, here you are, Black, and you show up in front of a white person. I could totally understand if you would have not surrendered to a white person, right? Like, there's all the reason not to, and yet you did, in a way. Like, you trusted that white person, right? Which there's all the reasons in the world not to, but you did, and then they ended up helping you. Which is interesting. Like, I don't know if you can, you know, what I wouldn't do is take a takeaway to trust white people to our listeners. That's not where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
Just so we're clear. And, you know, if you are a minority listening to this, I know you agree. So just for me to reiterate. But the interesting part is the surrender and the willingness to, you know, I think that is something, you know, in my story too. And I think a lot of the surrender is coming later in life for me.
That's an interesting question. Nobody really asked me that before. But you know, there's a little bit of kindness, right? That kind of cut through cultures, right? There's no one community or one group of people that have a monopoly, right? There is, you know, one group of people have a monopoly on suffering, right? That is, you know, Black people in this country. But, you know, I was given, it's not like I just end up in a place with people that are genuinely interested in the well-being of you know, other people. I mean, these people live on campus. They've given up, you know, whether they've given up their family or have family that. So there's about 250 boys that they're, you know, they were kind of given a responsibility to. And in my case, there was kind of an extra effort that they made. I spent a few years on the streets, and you know, my level of trust was not that great. You know, but you know, when you feel that kindness, right, there is something very, you know, like I grew up with a kind family. Like, my mother, like, is unconditional love, right? There is nothing I could do to offend her, right? No matter how much pain I caused, not one iota of disappointment. So I came from a culture that kindness, right, is not a so when I went all the way the other down and start kind of feeling this, right, like, I know this stuff, right? I mean, I know a whole lot of things, but I know when someone is like genuinely caring and interested in my well-being.
That's awesome. I mean, that thread of, and I'm glad you asked that question, Mark, but the thread of going all the way back to the unconditional kindness that your mother showed, that whether you could articulate it or not, or point to it or not, that really was the reason why you were able to flourish and thrive in this new environment that you were in, coming from and bringing with you all of the things that were in your bag. I mean, that was, that's so interesting. So flashing forward though, to the work that you're doing now. And
can I say one thing first?
Yeah, please.
So it's interesting, because I mean, we have like a script or guideline or things that we want to touch, but like, I think would be, because I've heard this before, right? Like, you could grow up poor, but have love.
Absolutely.
And kindness.
Yeah.
You know, I know he's an entertainer, But you know, you look at Kanye, right, and the connection that he had with his mother, mm-hmm. right, and you know, before she went on to become, you know, PhD and a college professor, you know, they struggled, and yet Kanye had her unconditional love and support, right. Mm-hmm. And Kanye, I don't think ever had a day in his life where he wondered whether he was loved. Right. And
at least not by his mom.
At least not by his, right. Which again, we could have a whole episode about the importance of that. Right. I mean, being biologically connected to our mother is a real thing. Yeah. Right. Like that is scientifically proven. Right. So to have the love of your mother, which is in, you know, the most connected person, you know, we were in them once. We were inside of our mothers once, all of us, we all have that in common. So, you know, I just think as I'm listening to Dr. Alamu in terms of like having that kindness, and if you don't have it, seeking it out, or, you know, given that it appears to be so important, right? I mean, N equals a couple, but you know, we've heard this time and time again, if you have this love and support, and then also if, you know, love and kindness was part of Dr. Alamu's upbringing, I'm sure contributed to being open to the white person when he got to the United States, right? Like he's grounded in love and kindness. And you know, I think that does get into, you know, because one of the questions I know we had on the list, and then Elaine, I'll turn it back over, is mm-hmm. Why do we think things are as bad as they are today, right? Yeah. Not only the, you know, just the mental health in general, right? Regardless of age, the statistics are abysmal. Dr. Alamu and I could rattle off all of them, but we've all seen them, you know, with... Yeah. Drug use and drug death and kids and adults, suicide rates skyrocketing, right? It wasn't what we had planned for the show to have this conversation about love and kindness. But you start to wonder if maybe that has something to do with the fact that things aren't as great as we'd like them to be. Maybe we need more of that, but you know, I'll stop there. And Elaine, I know you want.
Well, I think it's a maybe. We do need it. I think there's unfortunately a lot of people never either received it or they don't mm-hmm. know how to recognize it, and they don't mm-hmm. know. So you know, it's sort of a cyclical thing. Is you don't get it, you're searching for it. You don't know how to give it to somebody else, and then it just
or they don't know that that's what they're searching for, that's what they need, right? So there's the there's the unconscious, I'm not happy and things are bad, but I don't know what to do, right? Like you know, I'm close to 50 years old, and I think I'm just starting to figure that out, right? And you know, that's what it's all about, right? And I think that's what that's, you know, one of the many things, or not, you know, that's one of the things about the human condition. I think we share that. Like that desire for love and connection is something that we all have in us.
I'm convinced I am who I am partly because someone loved me unconditionally. Mm. Mm. When you strip, you know, all the other stuff, you know, at the basis, right? So it's you know, it's very difficult if that is missing somewhere. So it doesn't have to be your mother or father. It could be an aunt. There's a lot of people that can you know, fill that space. But it's very important to be able to, if you haven't found it, to find that, right? So, and what I, you know, when I, Mark knows this, when I tell people when we do some training on trauma and the consequence of trauma, what I say to them is, if you have a child, right, the thing that you want to give them, right? Not pay for, you know, swimming class and, you know, piano and all this stuff. What you really want to give them is give them the gift of attachment. Right? Mm. That is, you know, there's priceless what happens. There is biological reasons why that is important. There are, you know, so a whole series of things that are essential in that person's life. But if you can be able to give them that, right? It's more important than education. It's more important than all these other activities. It's more important than anything that you think is important these days, right? And so that's, you know, I mean, I can, you know, as you guys said, I can testify personally, right? All the fancy stuff I've gotten in treatment and all that, right? All that did for me was kind of uncover that foundation, right? Mm-hmm. I am loved, continue to be loved unconditionally by people in my life, right? And so there's no substitute for that. No amount of, you know, phone, no amount of money, no amount of, there is no other substitute, no amount of, is you know, this is not one of those things that you can easily substitute.
Yeah. So put that on a t-shirt, Mark. I wrote down from Dr. Alemu, is I am who I am because someone loved me unconditionally. Like,
yeah, I love it.
Like that's the quote of the day.
I'll get that into Madison here.
Right. Yeah. Like, so I feel like then, which I'm interested in, I know this isn't a show all about TQ intelligence, but we want to hit on it, but I think it's important for us to bring that. I feel like that's where I am in the questions that I want to know is now you went through the experience where you changed your life. You had people who poured into you. You you got treatment, and then you decided to through the path of your career, and you're deciding like, hey, I'm going to build this company. Tell me about TQ Intelligence. How did that? Obviously, we see the connections and threads back to your childhood and your life, but tell us about all of this and how it came together. Because I think it's really interesting. And at the point where we are in society where so much about technology is bad, like it recreates so many things, which you're talking about now, where people don't feel loved and they fall into moments of depression, and social media is just a spiraling loop of continuing to spew that. But then you're fusing, you're harnessing, wait a minute, I can take this science, this technology, and use it for good. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So about 3 years, I was running a community behavioral health agency, about 4,000 or 5,000 kids, all paid by Medicaid, and about 200 providers. And I walked out of that job because I cannot defend what we're doing based on data. I have anecdotal data, parents calling, you know, a great job and all that. There is some therapist that I would trust, but there's a whole bunch of therapists that I don't know what the hell is going on, what they're doing there. We were not collecting any data. We're to be able to, you know, saying someone is getting better, someone is not getting better. And so TQ Intelligence, born directly out of that, you know, frustration and the sense of failure that you know, we were collecting all this money from payers, but I just did not, you know, for the life of me, someone, you know, a payer will come and say, you know, so what's the return on my investment? Mm-hmm. You know, I'll forward you a couple of emails I got from parents about how great that we're doing. But don't ask me on the aggregate, right, at the population level, mm-hmm. whether we're making a difference or not. So unfortunately, that experience is very common. Right? Mm-hmm. This is where we need to talk about what happens to poor people, right? The very little interest in figuring out whether people are benefiting from these investments. Right? There is 45.
Well, there's an argument to be made that they don't want you to get better, right?
I mean, that's a. I mean, that is one argument, but I think we can. we can do better, right? We can, if I'm investing billions of dollars, you know, people always like, what about, you know, mental health and poor people, they all talk about, you know, it's not enough money. No, right now, money is not the issue. Right now, the issue is accountability and transparency, right? So you have, for example, the state that is investing a whole bunch of money, doing very little in terms of investing in any kind of outcome tracking. You have the federal government that also invests in these group of kids that disconnected from the actual practice, right? As long as they send the money, there's no, nobody's asking the question, right? You have payers.
Are they getting better, right?
Yeah, you have payers that are also get the money from the state and the federal government to administer that, that refuse to invest, right? We talked to a number of them, refuse to invest in anything that has to do with identifying whether someone is getting better or not, right? So we're in this conundrum, right? That we've been in this for quite a while, that you have a whole bunch of money flowing into these communities, but we know, you know, we know it's not working is because you look at the increase in the suicide rate for African-Americans is 76% in the last 10, 15 years, right? High school dropout rate, the number of kids that get involved with law enforcement, the number of kids that stay poor, right? So all the indicators that you have, right, it's not hopeful. It does not show that the money that is invested in here is actually making the difference, right? So this is what we're trying to do. Our fight is we want to get in the middle, right? And then measure whether someone is actually getting better or not. This is where, you know, all the barriers that we have to go through on a regular basis, right? I mean, Mark has been a great partner watching the daily, you know, combat, right? That what we want to do is, if you are paying for the services, if you say that you're providing these services, right? Why don't you spend just a minuscule amount of money, right? We tell them, for the price of one psychotherapy per year, one, right? We can be able to give you the data infrastructure, the innovation that allows you to measure whether the treatments you're providing is making a difference or not.
I had an old business partner said, I mean, it's nothing. It's not breakthrough, but it is. If you can't measure it, you can't fix it.
Right.
Right. So, you know, you start to wonder, like, well, you know, again, and Dr. Alamu and I, like he said, we suit up every day. You know, there's groups that are really interested in measurement, mm-hmm. right? And then there are groups that aren't. Why? Because, you know, A, they don't want the cat to get out of the bag that maybe right. what they're doing isn't effective.
Right.
And then they might have to work harder to make it effective. Mm-hmm. And then sadly, there's an element under there. And you know, as a white dude, I think it's fair for me to be the one to say it, that there's people out there who don't want things to get better, right? So we have different pillars of shit that we're up against, yeah. right? And you know, with TQ Intelligence, it's almost not almost it is it's the decoder ring to is what we're doing in these communities in terms of care. You know, is it effective? And if it's not, now we know, right? Which again, awareness in a lot of cases bad. Right. They don't want you to be aware. Well, now you know if right. it's good or bad. And if it's good, great, keep going. If it's bad, let's make some adjustments and fix it.
Right.
Right. So, you know, that it's one of the many reasons why I decided to join Dr. Alamu and the team is this daily fight. Mm-hmm. And it is a fight. And then two, and Dr. Alamu's humble in this regard. The concept of a biomarker, a human biomarker, like our bodies naturally are saying whether we're healthy or not, right? And
he's figured out to approach this from a voice perspective. Where listening to a child's voice can help determine the risk of that particular child, right?
So that's brilliant. The part that I want to, like, I'm trying to figure out, like, that technology, because a lot of people, particularly when you talk about things like this, is technology is the blame, right? Like, there's a lot of, you know, well, if we didn't have this, you didn't have that, or, you know, and now it's sort of, well, no, this is something that we can use actually to do that measurement piece. So we're not just playing an exhibition game. We're actually playing the playoffs. You know what I mean? Like, it's when you don't have a scoreboard, it doesn't matter what you do, right? There's no score, no way to measure. So forget it. You know, it's an exhibition versus, like, we're playing for the chip.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a nice way of putting it. I mean, it is that it is that stark, right? And you know, we did not start with voice. We started with using traditional, you know, survey measurements that are kind of subjective, but digitize that, create a system. But as we go further, like, we need more. We can't just, you know, this is the instruments of the last century, right? Our other areas of the economy has, you know, have moved on to things that are much more innovative. So we came to voice is partly because the relationship between voice and trauma. And so you have, if you've been part of a community that are dealing with generational trauma, we're not just talking about trauma, you know, in the recent past, we're talking about these generational traumas, right? I mean, Jim Crow was not like a long time ago, right? Reconstruction, it's 400 years. It's not really a whole lot of time from a kind of an evolutionary, the human experience perspective, right? Those experiences get encoded in a person's genetics and get passed on from one generation to another generation, and then reinforced by the environment from one generation to another generation, right? And so we are in a position to be able to identify those. It's partly because one of the things that happened with a person that was a history of trauma is there is a change in the person's cardiovascular activity, right? And that's why you see, you know, the problem with high blood pressure and all this stuff for marginalized communities, because trauma is first a physiological experience before it's an emotional one, right? It goes directly into the different parts of the organ, right? Make an impact on those, right? And that impact in some ways affects how we add our voices, right? And so when we talk about capturing these experiences that are enduring in a person and capturing the severity of it, is directly related to that relationship between trauma and the cardiovascular system, and then trauma and what happens to the brain as well, right? Mm-hmm. It impacts three parts of the brain that are very central for the person's overall functioning, right? The executive functioning, which you need if you're able to kind of, you know, work through, kind of you know, avoid this and defer this problem here or engage this. So these daily activities are primarily handled by the executive functioning. And then say the hippocampus, that has to do with learning, right? Kids who are impacted by trauma, right? It's very difficult for them to learn. It's partly because the hippocampus is not functioning well, right? Mm. Information needs to come in through the short-term memory, and then information needs to translate into the long-term memory. So when they sit in front of, you know, an exam, they can respond to that. The other one is the amygdala, that has to do with emotions management, right? So you see kids, you know, doing all kind of crazy stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so one way is, like, you know, that, you know, you can give it a, these are African American boys and they're always out of control and all that. But the reality is they're doing the best under the circumstances, partly because of the impact of trauma has not been recognized, has not been measured, has not been identified, right? Mm-hmm. And so we can't really treat someone in terms of mental health without really having the understanding of the depth of the trauma, right? Mm-hmm. So when we use voice, what we're doing is we're looking at there's a noise. There's a lot of noise over here, right? We're going right underneath, looking at all these other emotional experiences, physical experiences that directly impacts the person's ability to function on a daily basis.
Which includes speaking.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
It really is. And, you know, another piece that I've been learning about, I mean, if you just think of, you know, the brain alone, right? The body is complex, but the brain alone, you know, 90 billion neuron connectors, 10,000 neurons between each connector traveling at 270 million miles per hour is what sits atop our body, right? So it's not only the world's fastest supercomputer, it's the world's fastest supercomputer by a lot, mm-hmm. right? And it functions best when all the systems are aligned, right? If you put a stick into a CPU as it's going, what happens to the computer? It starts to smoke, right? Mm-hmm. And starts to break down. Same thing happens with our brain, right? And all of these traumatic events are literally, science has proven, fraying the neurons and the connectors, right? So the more trauma, the more fraying. And there's something called the beta brain, which is stress brain, where it's just the brain waves, all of the 90 billion times the 10,000, right? The waves are just bouncing into each other, which is causing the fraying, right? Which causes dysregulation, which causes confusion, which causes locking up, which causes your body to lock up. If your brain locks up, your body's going to lock up, right? So it's all connected. And yet the way the system is built, right, especially for communities of color and minorities and underrepresented communities, the way it's built is the fraying of these neurons exponentially goes up because of how difficult it all is. It's hard enough to be human to make sure that you can, you know, keep in mind, not only are we the world's fastest computer by a lot, we never shut off.
Right.
Right. When we're sleeping, the brain is still operating at that speed. Right. So if you have all of these challenges that are being thrown on a daily basis, and there's varying degree of those challenges, but it's known that the challenges are even higher in lower income communities, right? It's more fraying. The brain starts to smoke more. And when that goes, the body goes.
Yeah.
And here we are, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you take all of that and then, you know, take it back to TQ. Everything that we just talked about in terms of trauma, in terms of stress, in terms of fraying of the neurons, in terms of the body and the health of the body and the health of the brain, a lot of that we're going to provide visibility, or we do provide visibility to the reality of what that looks like. Right. The TQ score, the voice biomarker score, is going to be off the roof, off the charts in a lot of cases, you know, when we test these children. Right. And leverage TQ intelligence's technology. Now, just to touch upon the point about technology being bad, I agree it's bad. It's another layer of dysregulation. It's another stimulus. It's another something that the brain is trying to figure out, what the heck is this? Say nothing of the fact that there's self-esteem and things wrapped up in it. You know, I just thought of this, but TQ is a very non-invasive use of technology. We're serving as a method to capture one of the most natural things there is, which is speech, right? It just happens to be a mechanism, right? We're not showing up and disrupting people's lives. We're using the technology to capture what's already naturally happening in speech, which is pretty remarkable. I hadn't thought of that before, because again, I'm on the train of technology is, it's too much, right? It's another stimulus that our brain can't deal with, and we already have enough. And, you know, I don't know if this is scientifically proven, but I think it actually is. We were built to survive, right? Like fight or flight, safety, you know, wake up the next day or function or whatever it is. All of these other things, you know, it's I don't know if we were ever meant
to have all of these other things thrown at us. And we, in the communities of color and lower income communities, there's no way that the body and the mind and the were built to deal with some of the challenges that these communities experience on a daily basis. So that's the fight that Dr. Alamu started, and yeah. then I joined.
Yeah, that's a crusade right there. This
it is.
It's like, but I'm glad you all are in it, because if we think about today, and you know, we're talking about technology and how it can be used for all the evils, right? I mean, we're using technology now, so I will say, like, yeah. hey, I'm on the yes, we can use it to our advantage and make it so that it does become helpful and not harmful. But I'm there with you, Mark. Like, there's we got too many stimuli coming in. Yeah. And so when you add that on to all of the things that you and Dr. Alamu just talked about, it, like, it's compounded, right? It just yeah. gets even yeah. worse. Yeah. But then we yeah. add on just life. I mean, you yeah. all articulated it so beautifully with the science and with all the technical words. And for a lot of people, it's just like, life is just jacked up. I mean, like, it's just like, I came into the yeah. world, look around me, like, this is what I live in. And yeah. that's the way they articulate it. It's the same. It's the same thing that you all are talking about, but you have the language to describe it differently than someone who, you know, just lives and is like, this is all I got. Like, this is what it is.
Yeah.
But then you add on COVID, and you add on, you know, George Floyd, you add on all of these other, I guess I'm just going to call them
traumatic,
other stimuli, right? Like, there's just more
events.
Things coming at yeah. you, and it's more, yeah. and it's more life. And, you know, Mark, you said you wanted to ask earlier, like, you know, are things getting worse? Like, why is it worse? And I would love to hear your perspective on that, Dr. Alamu, because obviously we're going to agree with you. Like, yes, it's worse. Like, why is it? But why? What is it that is making it so much worse, particularly for certain groups of people, and particularly for the young people that you are serving too? Because, you know, this is, they're already dealing with, it's just jacked up on a day-to-day basis. It's Tuesday and it's jacked up, but now it's Tuesday and you got, you know, everything else on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is, you know, partly a clinical, partly a social problem that we have. So if you're a person of color, and understand that privileges are also, you know, not everybody has the same privileges just because you're a person of color. We want to be clear about that. And, you know, sometimes people who have accent like me have more privilege than people who grow up here. So there is, you know, we all kind of need to be aware when you get treated differently, it's not because you're special. It still come from this place of white supremacy. So you have kind of a struggle right now in people who want to do the civil war again. I mean, there's not a day that goes by that you don't hear things that are fundamentally someone is trying to challenge your own very existence. So we're in this very difficult place right now, trying to figure out in which directions that we're gonna go, right? And there are, you know, about 30-35% of the population that actually, you know, would like to reject the very existence of Black people primarily. I mean, this is, you know, whenever we talk about racism, white supremacy, the group that gets hit first, the group that's been here from the beginning, and everybody else kind of get some derivative version of that. Not everybody gets the same, have the same impact of those experiences, right? So if you're, you know, if you're a family from low income communities, right? Trauma does is it kind of concentrates the person into what do I need to do to survive right now? And when that happens, all the other extra things that the person needs to kind of grow, especially kids, are sacrificed, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're, you know, as a community, trying to decide whether we're going to move forward or they're going to move backwards in whose right going to be protected, you know, what kind of privilege is going to be assigned to. And so we, you know, COVID in some ways exposed problems that are already there, right? And so it's a, you know, there's nothing sexy about poverty, right? Poverty is in some ways is that you're like sipping a poison that you can't really test and you cannot really smell, right? By the time that you find out that you've been sipping it, the impact is already there, right? So trauma, right? And the experience of trauma is directly related to that experience of being poor, kind of being in this place of scarcity. You don't know what you're going to eat tonight. Tomorrow is not. So what happens is that the body changes how it operates and moves into this place of right now, what matters is survival, right? So you have these communities sacrificing their future, right? They cannot participate in the knowledge economy, right? In kids who cannot graduate high school, cannot do well, cannot go to college to some degree, will be in the same trap that their parents have been, right? They cannot participate in that knowledge economy where the mind is preoccupied with how I'm going to eat, how I'm going to survive today, how I'm going to stay away from the police officer, how I'm going to. So you have all those things. I mean, I got two kids, you know what I mean? I worry about my boy, then I worry about my girl, right? And it's a, you know, he was hanging out with his friends like downtown Decatur, and they're walking around. It's like, you know, that shouldn't be a problem. Like, I should not be worrying about. But like, what happened if someone identified them as, you know, group of, you know, pack, you know, they're walking one pack, they're threatening somebody else. These are just, you know, 15, 16 year old kids, right? So I'm at home, like on the phone, right? Checking, tracking what he's walking around, right? Speak of technology, right? Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, we have made progress. It's not, you know, so the progress has been made at the fundamental level, but we have not made any progress when it comes to poverty, right? In fact, the biggest changes when it comes to child poverty in the last 2 years is because of the COVID money. The number of kids that are under that category of being poor reduced by 50% because of that investment. But that investment is going to go away. Yeah. Right? So as long as we talk about mental, as long as we don't have a comprehensive plan to address poverty, right, it's very unlikely that we're going to make much progress when it comes to these other things. Like, you have less people mental health, less people being suicidal, less people, you know, being away from the, you know, criminal justice system, right? So at the root is that how much are we willing to invest? I mean, there was an attempt in the past, Congress have attempted to address some of these issues. It failed, right? It failed because the very same people that talk about the value of someone before they were born, but as soon as that person is born, it no longer have a value, right? Mm-hmm. So when you ask them to invest on people that are actually here, right, that becomes welfare. But when it comes to protecting someone who's not born, that becomes an ethical issue, right?
Well, what's not being discussed is, and again, it's another show. It's not that they want people born, it's they want white people born. Well, so yeah. Let's just call it what it is.
Yeah.
Right. So you know, that's another show, but it's also a truism that, mm-hmm. that doesn't get talked about. And again, this is the battle, right? So in terms of again, visibility is dangerous for a lot of people. Like, giving people headlights into reality is scary for a lot of people. And you know, we're gonna want to wrap up, but you know, a couple of takeaways, and Elaine, I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on this.
Sure.
Going back to the beginning, love and kindness.
Yes.
You know, and the importance of love and kindness, and how far off the rails we are, for various reasons, a lot of it intentional. Because again, I think deep down people know love and kindness is the connector, and love and kindness can do a lot. And if you obliterate love and kindness, then you start to see what's happening, right? Like the struggle, the dysregulation, the constant state of stress, the constant state of fight or flight makes it impossible for people to thrive,
yeah,
right? Because they're surviving, right? They're constantly surviving. And as long as you're in a constant state of survival, you're not going to be a threat.
Right.
And that's exactly what they want, right?
Yeah.
And again, that's another show, right? But this is how interconnected this all is, right? In terms of what TQ Intelligence is doing, in terms of what Dr. Alam is doing, in terms of what's going to chip away significantly is a return to love and kindness and connection. And enabling people to be in a better position to thrive, mm-hmm, than survive. And yet the system is either intentionally and or unintentionally, or a combination of both, set up for us to be in survival mode, or a lot of us, and some of us a lot more than others, mm-hmm, knowing that as long as they're struggling, they're not a threat, right? So that's what we're battling against on a daily basis. So I think there's some interesting show ideas in, yeah, here, Elaine, that we can, yeah, get into.
Yeah.
But I think, anything to add on that, Elaine?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely spot on. One of the things that was registering for me, though, and I'm just going to say this because I don't know how else to like articulate it, but also when you're constantly in survival mode, and this be interesting just to, again, later show maybe to get your perspective on this, Dr. Elmer, but if you're constantly in survival mode, what do you become? Like, can you use that and turn it into being a fighter? Like, are you, do you build some kind of resilience because of you've had to go through things? And that's, you know, a lot of times people say, you know, you can't overcome until you've actually been through some stuff. Now I totally get, like, you can't, there's a certain point, right? Like there's only so much a person can take until you get to, and everybody's level might be different. On the flip side of that, is there anything in there that we can take and we can use and harness to change it, to say, like, you now you've been through something, now you're even stronger at this, and can we pull those things out, and can we use mental health and wellness and the tools that you all are building and then the information that you're gathering, and saying, okay, now we've got a group of young people, right, who have been through something repeatedly. We got a biological marker for that, but is there something in that biological marker that we can use to turn into, now they've got a strength in this? Curious, just a question, I don't know, but that for me is like, is there even a thread of hope in here? Because we all know the situation that we're in, if we're going to election season, is a whole nother situation there. But there are people, there are systems, and just like Mark said, there are folks who they just have no interest. And even all of the data that we will gather and all of the things, they still, and so what? Like, we're going to continue to do all of these other things to basically mess up all the progress. But is there something that we can pull any glimmer of hope from that? But, you know, that's just a question that's sort of in my mind.
That's kind of gets the meat of, you know, where we go from here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're onto something. And I mean, there is, you know, there's always, you know, how is it that a group of people that was oppressed for 400 years, able to live and not just live a life that's joyful, I mean, without, you know, exaggerating, you know, produce, you know, whether it be art or other things that for others to experience joy like that. That makes, you know, that makes no rational sense, right?
Right.
So yes, there is something that we, you know, that has been, you know, art is one, you know, one of those areas that you can kind of get the answers. You know, what happened to that pain? What happened to that suffering? Right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to underestimate how that pain has devastated a community or a person. But there is still a struggle that to be able to live a life of meaning, right? Mm-hmm. Not you know, all this happiness stuff is you know, me and Mark talk about that. That's just the most ridiculous thing that I keep hearing, you know, whether, you know, a pastor saying that or a talk show host saying that, and this whole thing about happiness is going to make more people unhappy because they're chasing something that is not really doable as humans. But there is a way to live a life of integrity. There's a way, despite the pain, there's a way that you can live a life of meaning. There's a psychologist talked about kind of the redemption self, right? So despite your pain and as a person, right, you can engage on a daily basis how you can be able to improve the life of somebody else, mm-hmm. right? That's where the game is, right? It's not, yes, we have pain and this seems hopeless. And, you know, I get, you know, Mark knows there's days that I feel, you know, completely hopeless and defeated, right? But, you know, what is it that wakes me up in the morning, get me going the next morning, right? That one possibility, right? There may be this one person that, but what were we doing, right? The struggle that we're in on a daily basis, right? Mark's text message starts very early in the morning, right? Because if we wait until 8 o'clock, we probably have, you know, behind in terms of what needs to be done. So we got to get, you know, start working very early, right? and so it's a, you know, Mark has been sitting, I mean, he's been witnessing. So I said, why do you want to do this? He's witnessing, right? This kind of, you know, you know, we get what we get, right? As a Black founder, you know what we get, right? It's a daily dose of being undermined, you know, being asked to provide all kind of evidence. Like, I'm a scientist. I know about evidence, right? I know when someone asking me a dubious evidence because they can't come up and say exactly why they're asking me for this evidence, right? So to kind of watch him kind of being in the front, you know, it's like he's have a vision of how these things unfold, right?
Yeah.
From a theoretical, now it's practical. It impacts what we're trying to do.
I mean, being an entrepreneur, which I've been for most of my career now, it's hard. Like being an entrepreneur is hard, right? And I'm a white guy, and it's been hard, right? Like really freaking hard. And coming into this seat and sitting next to Dr. Alamu, he's got all of the hard that I experience, plus the unconscious and conscious bias against the fact that he's a Black founder. So talking about stress, again, that's just, again, it's a whole other episode, but like, I've been dysregulated by the stress of being an entrepreneur, and you get into a survival mode, right? And then, you know, you don't think as well, right? So just to think about when I've been in those situations, which have been plentiful, and then layer on all of this systemic crap on top of it, right? Which is the life of your community, right? We can't move forward unless we get to the underlying root of this. And again, we'll have a follow up show because, you know, we can literally go on for hours.
It's complex, people. It's complex.
And yes, Dr. Alamu, who's the founder and CEO of TQ Intelligence. But again, you start to see the complexity of what's underneath it all.
Absolutely.
And how the tool itself is, again, an uninvasive way of getting to the root of some of these things.
Yeah.
It's like a backhanded, behind the back Jedi mind trick type of way of getting to the visibility that we can say, see, there's a problem.
Yeah.
And now that we know it, we can go fix it. And I know you don't want this to be fixed, but it doesn't, we don't care. We're going to go after it anyway. So on that note, I want to thank Dr. Alamu for being on the show. Literally, so this is a lethal combination that we have on this screen. So Elaine and I, when we get together, we can talk for 5 hours. And Dr. Alamu and I, when we get together, can talk for 9 hours. So the three of us literally could be here all day.
Right.
And maybe that's another format for Tough to Talk About. It would just be a constant screen of just
like us. A day long. And we'll do a marathon podcast.
That would be.
If anybody could do it, it would be these three people. I also want to point out, I love that we have a black female, a black male, and a white male on the Zoom, because people are going to be listening to this on podcast. What would be nice if there was more of this in the world, and we would come together as humans and in love and kindness, because I can't think of two other people that I, you know, love more than the two people I'm looking at. I'm learning to love the other person in the screen. That's me. But so this here is a beautiful thing, and, you know, love and kindness, more of it. And just grateful to be here with you both. And Elaine, it's so good to see you as always. And Dr. Alamu, always great to see you. And thank you for coming on.
And great to meet you. We put it on the shirt. I am who I am because someone loved me.
Can you text that to me?
I will text it to you. Like that is going to be my quote of the day. I will give you the credit, obviously. But
the question I have, and we can talk, like I want to have like credit to Dr. Alamu.
We got to.
So it'll be like a quote.
It's been stolen from somewhere. So
okay.
But the other thing I want to say, if you want to send your kids to Harvard, right? Give them the gift of attachment, not this 25 different activities. Right?
Yeah. So. Amen. And Dr. Alamu says that to me all the time. And, you know, it's been wonderful to work with somebody who recognizes the importance of that connection between myself and my son.
Yeah.
And never comes close to trying to cut into that, because he does live by that mantra that the gift of attachment is the way to go. And thank you all. This was absolutely great. It was a great, as Elaine knows, Mondays and I don't get along so well, so this is a great way to get through a Monday. And until the next show, it was great to connect everybody, and we'll talk soon. Take care.
Pleasure meeting you, Elaine. Look you forward too. To connecting in person.
Absolutely.
All right. Bye, Mark. Thank you so much.
Hold on. Stay on for one.